I want to take a numerical illustration of the kind of points we were making before the break. And this is titled The Optical Illusion of Consumption as the Main Form of Spending. And on the supplement, I have a series of questions that pertain to this illustration, asking you to find total sales revenues in the economy, the portion constituted by consumption expenditure and productive expenditure, and so on. But let's look at this table for a moment. Up on the first row, we have profits plus wages is equal to national income, or alternatively, net national product, which is equal to consumption plus net investment. That's the general conceptual statement. And then in the second row, we have an arithmetical illustration of what's presented in the first row. So we're assuming that we have total profits in the economy of 150. That would be 150 in terms of hundreds of trillions in today's concept, in today's magnitudes, or perhaps not quite that great, but the fact that the numbers are small just saves us working with unnecessary zeros in our head. Most of us don't have all that extra space to begin with, so we want to hold down the expense. I include myself in that. We don't want to waste brain space on unnecessary zeros. So we're assuming profit is 150, wages and salaries are 450, and this is on a relative basis pretty much what it works out to be in most years. Profits typically amount to about 1/4 of the national income, and wages about 3/4. And so the total national income, net national product, is 600. In today's concept context, you'd have to multiply by a huge magnitude. And of that 600, perhaps 550 is consumption, and 50 is net investment. Now, the way the Keynesians look at matters, in their view, 550 of consumption pays 550 of the 600 national income, and net investment of 50 pays the remaining 50 of national income. Pardon me? Okay. Now, I think literally and figuratively, that is a very superficial view. That's just on the surface. If we look deeper and look at these magnitudes in terms of the accounting framework that we spent the first part of the class developing, here we have profits of 150, and that's the difference between sales revenues, broken down as between sales revenues representing consumption expenditure, S sub C, and sales revenues representing productive expenditure, S sub B, minus the costs, and then similarly with wages broken down. The fourth row is putting in numbers under these headings. So here we are with this 150 of profit. That reflects the difference between 1,000 of sales revenues minus 850 of costs. And those sales revenues are broken down, we're assuming, 500 representing demand for consumers' goods, 500 representing demand for capital goods, S sub B. And the wages, well, the wages of 450 are partly paid by the demand for consumers' labor, W sub C, but mainly by the demand for producers' labor, W sub B. And that would be a relative breakdown on this kind of order, 50 to 400. And so the numbers add up to the same. 1,000 minus 850, that's the 150, and 50 plus 400, that's 450. So we still get 600 as national income, net national product. But now, if we look and see what specifically is consumption expenditure, total consumption expenditure will be the 500 of demand for consumers' goods, that's this and also this, and 50 of consumer wage payments, W sub C. So this is where we get the 550 of consumption. And now this 50 of net investment, this is the difference between total productive expenditure, SB plus WB, minus the cost of business, and that's 500 We get that from over here, 500 SB. And the 400 of wage payments by business, we get that from over here. So if you take total productive expenditure of 900 and you subtract the 850 of costs, well, we have 50 of net investment. By now, hopefully you have the text in front of you, because I can't keep this on the screen and go back to the supplement. Now here we are, we have a series of questions. Using the data presented in that table, answer the following questions. 1A, find total sales revenue and income payments in the economic system. What is the sum of sales revenues and income payments? Yes,
Mr. Winch. The supplement, it says the table on page 708, which is table 15.5, it's a slightly
More
expanded table six. Than the one we were just looking at.
It says on 706 on the supplement.
There's two tables, 15-3 and 15-5.
Okay, right.
The one that the questions are referring to, I don't know.
All right, I'm sorry. I don't think it should matter. Try out 15-3 on 706. Thank you for calling that to my attention. I didn't realize it was inconsistent. We'll come back to that later table in connection with the next set of questions. I should make a note to correct that. Okay, so what would be the sum of sales revenues and income payments?
600.
Okay, Ms. Nikolova says 600. Does anyone else have an answer?
Sales revenue and
income payments. What is the totality of business sales revenues plus any direct payments of income? A payment that constitutes an income to someone. All right, Mr. Davis says 1,000 as representing what?
The sales revenues.
All right, now where do you get 1,000 for sales revenues?
Under the sales for business or producer, and then sale at 500, and sales under consumption at 500.
Okay, do you disagree with that, Ms. Nikolova? Mr. Davis is saying total sales revenues in the economy are 1,000, which he gets by adding up the SC plus SB. Sales revenues, you're saying, are 1,000. Okay, that's true. Now, what is the totality of sales revenues plus income payments?
1,450.
Mr. Wright is saying 1,450. Would you accept that, Mr. Davis?
I don't know the answer to income payment.
Well, a payment that constitutes income to the recipient.
Wages.
Yeah, wages and salaries.
So 14. All right, so then you have wages B and you have wages C at 450, so correct. 1450 would be the total answer.
Okay, does anyone have a different answer than 1450? Okay, well, sold to Mr. Davis for $14.50. That's the right answer. That's the right answer. $14.50 is the totality of sales revenues and income payments. That's the totality of total spending in the economy. Total spending is $14.50. Now, question B is, find the portion of total sales revenue and income payments constituted by consumption expenditure. How much of the 1450 is consumption expenditure?
550.
Any other answer than 550? It is 550. That's 500 of consumption expenditure to buy consumers' goods. That's 500 of S sub C and 50 of W sub C. So the consumption spending represents 550 of the 1450. And now question C is, find the portion of total sales revenue and income payments constituted by productive expenditure.
900.
That's 900. The 500 receipts from the sale of capital goods, S sub B, and 400 of producer's labor, demand for producer's labor, W sub B. Now, D is what portion of the wages of 550 is paid by consumption expenditure?
50.
I hear 50. Do I hear anything else? 50. It's only 50. Consumption only pays 50 of wages, the W sub C. What portion of wages is paid by productive expenditure?
500.
500. I'm sorry, 400. Excuse me. 400. 400. So notice, of wages, the overwhelming bulk, 400, is paid by productive expenditure. Only 50 is paid by consumption expenditure. Now, is any income actually paid by consumption expenditure? When you buy somebody's product, when you're making a purchase of consumer's goods, what are you actually providing to the seller? Are you paying his profit?
No.
You're paying his sales revenue. You're paying the sales revenue. And you're doing that also when you make productive expenditures to buy his products. Now, we could attribute profit to sales revenue. So we could say, all right, we know the total profit is 150 and it's earned on total sales revenues of 1,000. And we could attribute 75 of the profit to 500 of the sales revenues and the other 75 to the other 500. We could do that. So if I ask the question, what part of total income is either paid by or attributable to consumption expenditure, and what part of total income is either paid by or attributable to productive expenditure, and understanding the word the words attributable to as applying to how we allocate profit over the sales revenue, how would you answer that question? Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Question for clarity.
Okay.
When you said income, when you say, can you help further define income? Are you talking about the sales revenue to the producer, or are you talking about the wage earner?
Well, when I say
net income,
when I said sales revenue or income payment, I was referring to the only income paid is wages. You don't pay someone a profit, you pay a sales revenue. Now I'm asking what part of income is either paid by or is attributable to consumption expenditure, and what part is either paid by or attributable to productive expenditure, with the words attributable to be understood as how we allocate profit in relation to sales revenue. We know 150 of profit is earned on 1,000 of sales revenue. And when I say attributable to, I have in mind that 75 of the 150, half of the 150 of profit, could be attributed to 500 of the sales receipts, and the other half to the other 500 of sales receipts. So if we do that, and I ask the question again, what part of total income is either paid by or attributable to consumption expenditure, and what part is either paid by or attributable to productive expenditure, what would be the answer to that?
Half. Did you say half?
75.
Well, that applies to what, the 75?
Consumption.
That's half of profit, right?
Right.
But I'm asking, what part of total income is either paid by or attributable to productive expenditure? And what part is either paid by or attributable to consumption expenditure?
And what would that be to production?
Well, that's profit.
75
of profit is attributable to the 500 of consumption expenditure, buying consumers' goods. 75 of profit is attributable to 500 of productive expenditure, buying capital goods.
Right.
But we have, what about the income of the wage and salary earners? That's 450, right?
Right.
And you already answered that question in E.
Yeah.
So what do you get if you put E together with our attribution of the 150 of profits? 475 would be what? 475 is what?
Productive expenditure.
Is the part of income which is either paid by, i.e. the 400 of wages, that's paid by productive expenditure, and the 75 of profit earned on the receipts from the sale of capital goods, that's attributable to productive expenditure. So of the total income of 600, 475 is either paid by or attributable to productive expenditure. And how much is either paid by or attributable to consumption expenditure?
The difference.
125. 75 of the profit earned on 500 of receipts from the sale of consumers' goods, and 50 of the wages that are paid by demand for consumers' labor. So notice, when we look at it this way, of the 600 of national income, instead of 500 being paid by consumption and 50 paid by net investment, it's almost the opposite. It's 475 is paid by or attributable to productive expenditure, and only 125 is paid by or attributable to consumption expenditure.
Sorry, can you break down real quickly the components that make up the 475? The 400 comes from wages.
And 75 of profit.
Of the profit.
We're dividing. See, we had 150 of profit.
And you're saying half the profit's coming from production, the other half's coming from
investment. We're allocating the profit in proportion to the sales revenues. So if half the sales revenues are S sub B and half are S sub C, we're allocating the profit 50-50. Yes, Mr. Bowman.
I understand how we got to 1, B, C, D, and E, but 1A has got me confused how we got to 1,450. I can't see that in here, so I'm probably not looking.
Okay, all right.
At the right.
Let's try that. All right, let's go back here. We'll look at it right here. All right. The question is total sales revenues and income payments.
Right.
All right, what are total sales revenues?
S sub B.
See, here's profit. Profit is sales minus cost, right?
Okay.
So these two together represent the sales. A thousand of sales revenues.
Okay, so that's 150 plus the 450 equals 150.
No.
Okay, I'm going down to number four.
Yeah.
Go to number four, yeah.
That's 1,000 minus
850. Right. That is okay. That's how we get the 150
right.
So of profit.
Understand that.
Okay, so what's the sales revenues here?
Sales is 1,000.
The sales revenues are 1,000.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So we know sales revenues are 1,000.
Okay.
And now, what are wage payments?
The 50.
450. 50 of this and 400 of this.
Oh, okay, I got the wage.
So the answer to the question is the totality of sales revenues and wage payments.
Okay, thanks.
Now, it might be helpful if we can look at that concept separately. Gross national revenue. Let's just say a word about that. We can take gross national revenue, or we could modify it to gross domestic revenue, and think of it as being the totality of sales revenues plus wage payments. In our illustration that we just looked at, this is 1450. Gross national revenue would be 1450. And how would it break down as between consumption expenditure and productive expenditure in that illustration?
500.
Half. No. No, 500. Well, we had a separate question. How much of the 1450 is paid by consumption expenditure? How much is paid by productive expenditure?
500.
Yeah, 550 is consumption, 900 is productive expenditure. Costs are 850. Okay, now notice, here we are, we have this concept, gross national revenue, the totality of sales revenues and wage and salary payments. That's gross national revenue. Looked at as expenditures, it's total consumption expenditure and total productive expenditure. Now we can go from this huge magnitude straight down to national income in one fell swoop. How do we do that? We subtract costs from sales revenues. That reduces sales revenues to profit. We still have wages. Now we have national income. We go from gross national revenue to national income just by deducting costs from sales revenues. On the other side, if we deduct the same cost, these same costs here, over here now, but deducted from productive expenditure, what is that reduced to?
Net investment.
Net investment. So at one fell swoop, we go from gross national revenue, total expenditure, to national income, net national product.
Good table.
Pardon me?
It's a good table.
Well, thank you very much. Now, how would GDPs fit in here, or GNP? Well, that's simple. If instead of subtracting the totality of cost, if we don't subtract the totality of cost, we subtract merely all costs but depreciation. If we subtract all the costs but depreciation, then we have GDP, or GNP. See, because that would mean, if we're not subtracting depreciation, then that's equivalent to net investment plus depreciation, and that's what is called gross investment. So the GDP, you can think of GDP is gross national revenue minus the totality of selling, general, and administrative expenses and cost of goods sold. If you take away a total selling, general, and administrative expenses and cost of goods sold from what I'm calling gross national revenue, you have so-called GDP, GNP. Yes, Mr. Whitty.
So on the third line down at the bottom, the Y slash NNP, that's the Y is the same thing as NNP?
Yes, okay. The Y is the same thing. It's not divided by.
Yeah.
Okay. I hope you all understand that.
I know we've gone over this many times, but to belabor one more time.
That's okay, yeah.
The gross national revenue differs from gross national product in what respect?
It surpasses gross national product by the sum of cost of goods sold and selling, general, and administrative expenses. You see, if you started off with consumption plus net investment, and you add depreciation allowances to net investment, you have what is today called gross investment. But that's still net investment on account of inventory. If you add cost of goods sold to net investment on account of inventory, you then have total productive expenditure on account of inventory. And if finally we add to that what we could call gross investment, if we add selling, general, and administrative expenses, then we have total productive expenditure. Now you see, this framework doesn't throw out GDP or national income or net national product. It looks at them from the perspective of a larger starting point. And it's able to identify that most of the spending in the economy is not consumption spending, but productive spending. Most of the actual spending is productive spending. And now, well, I assume you all have this handout from last week. If there anyone who doesn't have it, I'll be glad to give you one.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is from a few editions back of the textbook by Paul Samuelson and William Nordhaus. And I would just like you to take a couple of minutes and read the discussion starting under the heading The Multiplier. Read from there down to the end. Pardon me?
It's not right, is it?
What he's claiming here?
Yeah.
All right, now why do you say it's not right?
I think you wrote about this. There's no allocation for the cost
of those steps. Well, there's no discussion of cost, that's true. But there's a bigger problem than that, actually. It's good that you see that there's something wrong here. It really is wrong. You see, now we have a framework, we can test what he's saying against our own framework. Yeah, Mr. Wright.
What he's calling consumption spending is actually productive spending, isn't it? When he's talking about the carpenters and lumber producers will get an extra, it's not the end of, he's calling that they're going to be buying consumption goods, but aren't the goods that they buy, how's he coming up with that figure? Aren't they going to be buying goods to reinvest, to more making productive expenditures, not consumptive expenditures? That's not what it says.
You're asking, say again.
I'm sorry, there was... It says he hires, pays them $1,000, they get that extra $1,000 of income, they consume two-thirds of it, they will not...
Yeah.
Secondary, no, I'm sorry.
Are you saying that it forgets the wage income? Is that what you're...
Pardon me?
You're saying that it forgets the
wage income? Well, I would have to say yes and no. He doesn't think he's forgetting it.
Right, but that's
what... That's the calculation that actually says.
All right, have you finished all of this? Anyone need a little more time? Give me some indication if you need more time.
43 more seconds.
Okay. Okay, this multiplier doctrine, I think you'll find in just about all of the macroeconomics texts of the last 65 years or so, 60 years. And this is a very typical example. And what's argued is we start off with some initial spending. And that spending is alleged to cause equivalent additional income. In this example, he's got $1,000 of additional spending, and that supposedly creates $1,000 of additional income to the recipients. And then it's assumed that the recipients will consume two-thirds of that additional income, which is called, in very fancy language, the marginal propensity to consume. And their consumption, their two-thirds consumption, which is 666.67, that will generate a further equivalent rise in income of 666.67. Out of that further rise in income of 666.67, there'll be a consumption of two-thirds of that, which will then generate still more income, this time 444.44, and on indefinitely in ever-diminishing increments. and the result will be a total increase of $3,000 in income. And here the multiplier would be 3. Now notice what's allegedly generating the additional income is consumption, just consumption. Where is saving here? He has a reference or two to saving, but saving is implicitly 1/3 at each stage, right? But pardon me?
He doesn't calculate for.
Well, what is the implication of the effect of saving on the amount of further spending? Pardon me?
It's not being accounted for, it seems, is a reinvestment.
Is he saying it's reinvested?
No, my point is it's not showing that it's reinvested.
Right, it's not showing. What's the implied treatment of saving?
Hoarding.
It's hoarding. It's disappearing. It's a leakage. We have this thousand of initial spending. In the next round, 1/3 of that spending has leaked away into saving. So we now only 2/3 is carried forward. Then there's a further leakage, and the process ultimately stops when we have 1,000 of new and additional saving. At that point, everything has leaked into saving. Now, he suggests alternative examples. He says this shows in the right hand column after his illustration. This shows that with a marginal propensity to consume of 2/3, the multiplier is 3. It consists of the 1 of primary investment plus 2 extra of secondary consumption respending. The same arithmetic would give a multiplier of 4 for a marginal propensity to consume of 3/4, which would mean what about saving? How big would the marginal propensity to save, which he describes as the twin concept, that would be 1/4. Now notice, when the marginal propensity to save is 1/3, the multiplier is 3. If the marginal propensity to save were 1/4, the multiplier would be 4th. And he gives you a general formula. He says our simple multiplier formula is, a little bit higher. He says if the NPS were 1 over x, the multiplier would be x. So suppose the marginal propensity to save were 0.1, just 10%. What then would the multiplier be?
10.
So according to this analysis, the increase in income is the greater, the smaller is saving, and the larger is consumption. It's consumption which is generating the incomes. Saving is just a leakage disappearing into hoards. Now, it's believed, according to this analysis, that when you stimulate consumption, if we were doing this and we had unemployment, what would supposedly be the effect on employment?
Would improve.
Employment is supposed to improve, right? We have the additional consumption. That's supposed to cause employment to improve. So when Samuelson is talking about the additional consumption boosting national income, and he's saying our initial investment expenditure has a multiplier of 3 and contributes to a 3,000 rise in national income, what is he implying is happening to the demand for labor and overall wage payments? That they're going up too, but most of this represents an additional demand for labor. Well, this is the old fallacy that when you're buying the consumer's goods, you're paying the wages, you're buying the whole banana all up and down the line. That's present here. We have now the means of looking at this more closely in detail. And I say that when we do this, under A, I say the only incomes raised by successive rounds of consumption expenditure envisioned by the multiplier doctrine would be profits, not wages. Any rise in wages in the demand for goods at wholesale, in the demand for capital goods of any kind, that depends on saving, which the Keynesians regard as a leakage and as allegedly diminishing the subsequent incomes. Now, what we can do, Samuelson talks about 1,000 of initial investment, and I'm asking you to plug in his 1,000 of initial investment into SB, and his implied 2,000 of induced consumption into S sub C. Now, the framework that I have here, my own example, uses smaller numbers. Let me go back. Here we are. I'm not working with 1,000 here. I'm working with an increment of 10 in that investment to keep things in scale. Notice on row two, in row two, in my table 15.5, I'm assuming we have a rise of 10 in net investment. It goes from 50 in row two it was 50. Row two is a repetition of what we already saw. And now I'm assuming that in row three, we introduce an increment of net investment of 10. Samuelson's example is 1,000, and we're making it 10. And we're assuming that there's a marginal propensity to consume of 3/4, a marginal propensity to save of 1/4. All right, what then is our multiplier, according to Samuelson's? Four will be the multiplier. So how much should we expect national income, net national product to rise with an MPC of 3/4 and an increment of 10 of net investment? It should rise by 40, right? And here we're showing 40. Now, national income, net national product is 640 instead of just 600, okay? And how much of a rise in consumption have we had? How much of an induced rise in secondary consumption respending is there?
30.
And that shows up in consumption being 580 instead of just 550 where it was originally. So we're following out the analysis just as he presents it. Okay, there's one problem. The way he and the others who share these views view things is most of this rise in income will represent a rise in wage payments and the demand for labor. They're not breaking down the kind of income that's being increased. They assume it's spread out in the usual proportions. But now we want to plug in the numbers in terms of our old friends down in row four, where we have things worked out, S sub C plus SB minus D, that's the profit, and the W sub C and WB, that's the wages. All right, here we are. Row five is what we looked at previously as row four. We have the same numbers. This corresponds to row two. And now we're introducing 10 of net investment and getting 30 of secondary consumption respending. Okay, we're assuming that the 10 of net investment is going entirely for capital goods. So in his carpenter's lumber example, I will assume that the whole 10, let's say, is spent for lumber. And we can modify the example shortly to allow some being spent for carpenter's wages too. But let's assume here we are, we've got 10 of additional expenditure going for building supplies. Okay, what kind of revenue is that? If someone is spending 10 for building supplies and building equipment, what kind of revenue will that be 10 to sellers? That's 10 in amount, but as between sales revenues and wages, what is it? I go into Home Depot. Yeah. I spend 10 buying lumber and screwdrivers and whatever. What is the money that I paid from the perspective of the recipient? It's sales revenues, right? I haven't paid any wages yet.
Right.
Now, if I hired someone, if I spent 5 in Home Depot and spent 5 employing a carpenter, then I'd have 5 of wages, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's start off assuming we have 10 spent for building supplies. Now, what is supposed to be the effect of that on the income of the seller?
Income increases by 10.
The income increases by 10. But if our expenditure constitutes 10 of sales revenues, what would be the nature of the income that increases by 10? If here we are, we have 10 more of sales revenues, and we're assuming that the income of the seller is also up by 10. What would be the nature of the income that's up? Is it A, wages, or B, profits?
Profits.
It's profits. The only income that would rise on the strength of a rise in sales revenue is profit. Now, we're asked to assume that two-thirds of the profit, not named as profit, but two-thirds of the income will be consumed, and that will generate $666.67 more of spending and income. Well, and it's argued that we'll have, with a multiplier of four, how much secondary consumption respending should we have on top of the initial 10 of net investment?
40.
Well, 40 is the increase in income altogether, but 10 of that 40 is the initial net investment.
30.
So there's 30 of secondary induced consumption. Now, when people are consuming, what sorts of things are they buying when they're consuming? How much, to what extent do you think people are running out to employ additional maids?
Not much.
I think that would be insignificant, right? So if they're consuming, how should we classify the 30 of their consumption from the perspective of the people receiving the 30? My income is up by 10. I'm consuming $666.67 more, or $6.67. Would I be employing labor, or would I be buying products and services from business firms?
Yeah.
Products and services from business firms. And if there was further consumption as the result of that, where would it show up? As a demand for labor or a demand for products and services of business firms? Products and services for business firms. So now, if we have 30 of this secondary induced consumption, where should we show it? As 30 more of demand for consumers' goods, 30 more of additional S sub C. So here we are, we now have 530 of demand for consumers' goods and 510 of demand for capital goods, and we still have the same 850 of costs. What is the effect, what kind of income has increased here?
Profits.
The profits have risen from 150 to 190. Have wages improved? No, they're unchanged. So if the multiplier worked, if things actually worked the way the proponents describe matters, any increase in income that was brought about would be an increase in profit income, not wage income at all. And there'd be no further increase in the demand for capital goods. The only increase in the demand for capital goods would be when that initial net investment occurred, when that initial investment spending took place. Thereafter, the only increase we would have is an increase in the demand for consumers' goods. And the only additional income that would be generated would be profit. There'd be no additional demand for labor. What would we need to have happen in order for there to be an additional demand for labor and a further additional demand for capital goods? So when a seller's sales revenues goes up as the result of additional spending, what would be required for the spending of that seller to result in either an additional demand for labor or an additional demand for capital goods, or the two together?
Investing.
What would he have to do? Will it happen if he's consuming the additional income?
No. Wages.
What does he have to do in order to be able
save.
He has to save the additional revenue and income. The whole rise in any further spending, as far as it would go for labor or capital goods of any kind, depends on the extent to which the sellers abstain from consuming their additional revenue and save and productively expend them. They have to save and productively expend in order to have any additional demand for labor or demand for capital goods. That is not seen by the multiplier analysis. Instead, it regards saving as a drain, a leakage, as an antisocial phenomenon that thinks that everything depends just on consumption. The reality is that if there's to be any benefit from the additional spending, it has to go in the form, it has to be saved and productively expended. It doesn't occur in the mere act of consumption. And if all we had is consumption going on, the only income that would be higher would be profits, not wages. What would that be doing to the share of income going to the wage earners relative to the profit earners?
Diminishing.
It would be diminishing the wage share. What would it be doing to the demand for consumers' goods relative to the demand for capital goods? Pardon me? It would increase it. It would mean an economy that would concentrate more heavily on the production of consumers' goods, less heavily on capital goods. What would happen to our ability to maintain our supply of capital and maintain our ability to produce? All of that would go down the tubes. So if things work the way the multiplier analysis describes, it would be an actual disaster. Fortunately, things do not work that way. Now, I think I've given you the gist of what's wrong here, so I don't think we actually need to work the specific examples in class. You might work these on your own. I think I ask them in the short answer questions on the website, and if I do, I'm sure I provide the answers. I can give you the answers here. Under D, if the entire 1,000 of initial investment took the form of SB and the implied 2,000 of secondary consumption respending was SC, then what's the increase in wages? Zero. What's the increase in profits? In this example now.
1,000.
Well, how much is the total increase in national income using Samuelson's numbers?
30.
Well, use his numbers on the flyer on what I gave you. Yes?
3,000.
Okay, that's the increase in income. And what income would be increased? State the increase in profits. What's the increase in profits?
3,000.
It would be 3,000. Now, if we assume that 500 of the initial investment is wage payments, which is closer to his example, and only 500 is demand for capital goods, well then, I ask you to repeat steps D and E. State the increase in wages. We have an initial 500 of wage payments. We have 500 of SB, and then we have 2,000 of induced S sub C. What's the increase in wages? What's the increase in profits? Yes, Mr. Wright?
525.
500 for?
500 for increase in wages.
500 the increase in wages and 2,500 the increase in profits. How do you get that, Mr. Wright?
Because $500 is being spent productively with the increase in wages, and then 2,500 is the profits, the difference.
Okay, it's 500 is present in the initial wage payments, and then if all we have is further consumption, we have 500 demand for capital goods to begin with, alongside the wages, and then we have 2,000 of S sub C. So we have 2,500 more in sales revenues. If that's the additional income, which is the only possibility here, then the income is 2,500 more in profit. And we could take different assumptions. The answers, if we use an MPC of 0.75, we'd have zero of wages, 4,000 of profit, or 500 of wages, 3,500 of profit. Then we'd have, if we use an MPC of 0.9, we'd have, again, zero of wages and 10,000 of profit, or if we allow for the initial 500 of wages, we have 500 of wages and 9,500 of profit. Now, one other last touch, perhaps. In reality, if we had succeeding rounds of expenditure, when people go in and consume, what typically happens to the size of the seller's inventory? It'll go down. It goes down. And to the extent that happens, what's happening to the magnitude of cost of goods sold in the economy? That's going up. And so, if here we are, we have an initial investment expenditure, like 1,000 in Samuelson's example, and then we have successive rounds of consumption, if that's resulting in additional physical sales volume, we should have additional cost of goods sold taking place at each round, which would have what effect on the initial amount of net investment? It would be decreasing. We have our initial 1,000 of productive expenditure, and then we'd have succeeding amounts of cost of goods sold. So the overall effect on net investment would be that it would be diminishing, which means that you can't take some additional amount of net investment for granted as then being followed by more consumption. It starts wiping out the initial net investment. There'd only be one way that that could be avoided. What would be required so that we could have additional consumption spending and it not result in additional cost of goods sold? We start off, there's a limited expenditure for plant and equipment and wage payments, and we're assuming that that's equivalent income, and then we're going to have further consumption generating further equivalent income. What would have to be present so that as and when we did have additional expenditure to buy products, we did not have additional cost of goods sold? Let's visualize, pardon me?
That's work in progress.
What would be required so that a Home Depot could be greeted with an extra $100,000 of spending to buy its products and not have any additional cost of goods sold as a result? What would be,
pardon me? Higher profits.
You have to raise prices.
If prices rose, if the whole rise in spending simply contributed to higher prices on the same physical quantity of goods being sold, then there's no rise in cost of goods sold. Then you have the rise in income and it's all profit. That's what's implicitly present in this kind of example.
I thought you were
going to
say warranties.
Well, I don't think the warranties would be a factor.
You can sell extended warranties, and that's like a source of revenue.
I have to sell a lot of that.
Okay, we'll sell extended warranties. I can see how the extended warranties. Well, I don't know that they represent sales revenues. I don't think that you would treat the sale of warranties as a revenue. You have to reserve most of it to pay for future repairs. And you'd only be taking it into revenue as time passed. An interesting complication. Okay. You're concerned, what you'd be saying to other people in the business world? You should know, even if your own understanding is less than perfect, you should know that there are serious holes in what they're telling you, that you might be able to understand better with more study and work. But you should have a very skeptical attitude toward what you're reading and hearing, and know that there are some enormous gaps in what's being propounded. Yes, Mr. Davis.
Just out of curiosity. When you're in environments with other professors, maybe a symposium or another, another environment that allows you to present these concepts, how is it accepted or received by your peers?
They're not interested in discussing things like this.
Really?
No. The people I know are not. Now, there are some people here and there who are interested, but the immense majority are simply not interested.
Why are they not interested?
They don't want to. They're not open to ideas like this.
Close my ears.
You can describe it as you wish. I can't disagree with that. But they're not very many people who are actively intellectually interested, and certainly in hearing ideas that undercut so much of what they believe.
Are there any opportunities to speak to such things?
There are some, and on some occasions I do. Now. I've had an article published last July in a, I guess you'd call it a second-tier journal, presenting this critique of double counting. Someone wrote in an attempt to critique it. I have replied to his critique. I don't think he did very much, if anything. But as far as I know, there hasn't been much response or interest. So we'll see what happens as time goes by. Yes, Mr. Boisson.
Do you have national conferences where, I guess I could classify you as kind of an economist, where you guys get together and have forums and talk about your different philosophies and try to sell each other on your different ideas?
Well, you'd think there are, but nothing works out that way to any great extent. There are meetings of different organizations. Papers are presented, and typically if you present a paper, maybe you get 20 minutes or half an hour to give a presentation. Most people would not be listening too attentively. And yeah, publications, there are journals. Most of the articles are not read.
You're bursting my bubble of higher academics.
Well, it's a bubble that needs bursting. Sorry to tell you.
When there's a journal that's published, what would you say the readership or the distribution, like for an article that you would write, how many people is that going to reach, and then how many do you think are actually reading it?
I don't know. I would say my best outlet, there's a website, I think there's a link to it on the course website, is the Von Mises Institute. And I have an article up there right now that went up yesterday. It stays on their homepage, or the lead into it stays on their homepage for about a week. And maybe several thousand people might read that. I think that's much more than would read a journal article. Yeah, Mr. Sweeney.
The article you emailed us, what kind of reaction did you get to that? I showed it to some people
in
my work, and I got some various reactions.
Yeah. I got a really good reaction.
I got good and negative.
Well, the Mises Institute has a blog, and you could most of the reactions were put on the blog. So if you're interested, you could track it down. One notable reaction I got was from some guy who was just fuming, and he was denying the law of demand. I was tempted to write a reply to him, but I didn't. Saying your reply proves a number of points. You're very, very angry. You don't know anything about economics. You do know how to spell horseshit. That would have been my reply. I mean, you don't know who's the psycho, and you don't want to set someone off. But that's the reply.
Why do you like that?
Yeah, Mr. Riches.
It seems like your book's pretty well reviewed. Like you go on Amazon and it's well reviewed. Is it used by a lot of economics professors at schools across the country?
Pardon me?
Is it used by a lot of economics professors?
It's used by a handful.
A handful.
Yeah. There's someone at National University who uses it. There's someone at Bryan College who uses it. There used to be someone at Johns Hopkins who used it. I think there are some people. The book is on the web,
yeah,
in a form that you can't print pages or cut and paste. And I'm sure, judging from the response on my own website, there are probably some classes here and there where they have portions of it assigned. But it's by no means a runaway bestseller.
It seems like if you go on Amazon, it gets really good reviews.
There are some very good reviews on Amazon, and the rankings at Amazon can be affected very heavily by very small numbers of copies.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Taylor.
So why has Pepperdine chosen to use it? Why do you think?
The Pepperdine has not chosen to use it. I've chosen to use it.
26 years of experience. I don't know. Maybe we have a false assumption. But again, this goes back to earlier. I mean, I feel like Pepperdine chooses instructors and coursework on purpose.
No, there's not that much conscious knowledge and awareness. No. There are moves in the works, which I'm resisting, to require everybody to devote 75% of every course to teach it in the exact same way. I'm trying to fight that. Maybe I can. I'm not going to be here that many more years in any case. But if that were enforced, I probably just couldn't stay here.
Wow.
Yeah, Mr. Whitesides.
Okay. Do you think that Pepperdine knew what they were getting?
Probably not. No.
It's a question that I pondered because, like, you know, I talked to you earlier about how there's like two, maybe three economic programs in the United States that
teach, you know, von Mises economics, you know, like Auburn and UNLV, and like that's about it. And like, you know.
Well, there may be a few more places. There's something on the Mises.org website that lists a number of schools with different people. But it's certainly not, by any means, terribly influential.
Yeah, it's a sort of Pepperdine's conservative institution, and I mean, you know, move that away from the politics, it's a fairly conservative point of view as an economist.
You would think so, that they project that impression, but I don't think that's really true.
Well,
I have a very hard time.
Many, many other institutions.
Well, possibly.
You know, that's like calling the Orange County Register a conservative paper. And compared to the Times, it's very conservative.
Well,
in reality, it's quite liberal.
Well, not their editorial page, maybe the body of the paper now. Yeah. Okay, well, I thank you for your interest in the state of affairs. Okay. Let's turn now to a new major related subject, which I'd like to make some substantial headway onto, hopefully even finish. And this is the subject of capital accumulation. And what it depends on. And let me start with this point A under number one, that real wages depend on the productivity of labor. We've spent quite a bit of time, actually, before the midterm looking at this. The higher the output per worker in the economy, the more abundant is the supply of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor. Therefore, the lower prices will be relative to wages, and thus the higher are real wages. Well, what makes the subject of capital accumulation so vitally important is that it is the main determinant of the productivity of labor. What the productivity of labor depends on is the kinds of tools and equipment and materials that the worker is able to work upon. If you want to see the significance of this, consider conditions in any third world country. You have a knowledge base. You've seen all kinds of movies and newsreels and read books and so forth. If you're looking at how they grow crops in a third world country, what sorts of tools and implements would they be using?
Slash and burn.
No. What I mean?
Yeah, manual.
It could be
animals.
You might have possibly, in the worst cases, a human being pulling a plow. If they get beyond that, well, maybe they have an oxen pulling the plow, or something like an ox. They're not using tractors or harvesters. So, how much can you accomplish with a given amount of labor if it has to be by hand to that extent? Not very much. When they're producing building materials, if they want to make wood for a structure, how do they have to go about getting the trees down and cutting them up?
Nice.
It would be guys with saws or axes, and then they'd have to saw the planks, assemble everything by hand. Just think how laborious that is, and thus how little they're able to produce. If they're making clothing, they may be weaving it by hand. So it's this way, case after case. In a first world country, we're growing food with tractors, harvesters, chemical fertilizers, automatic irrigation systems. We have high-powered giant saws to fell the trees, cranes to lift them onto flatbed trucks or railway cars. We have giant sawmills to cut huge tree trunks into neatly sliced planks. We have highly automated clothing factories, shoe factories, everything. And so we produce so much more per unit of labor, that makes goods so much more abundant relative to labor, and prices low relative to wages. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
Okay, this concept is, like, you know, very, very clear and simple to me, right?
Yeah.
As I think it is to a lot of people who have read Hazlitt or any other, you know, have sat in this class for, you know, a couple of sessions.
Yeah.
But my question is it just because of, you know, resistance to change that people, like, fail to accept this, or, like, fail to recognize that, you know, that there's all these, you know, labor unions and other false facades and, you know, things that are slowing down productivity, that like are, you know, holding, you know, trying to keep a cap on productivity, you know, like falsely, you know, whether it's government intervention or whether it's, you know, through labor unions or whatever, that everybody in the room wants more capital, of course, you know, whether it's personal capital or, you know, productive capital or whatever, everybody wants more capital to accumulate, but it's all based upon productivity. And if why isn't von Meissian economics more popular? Like, why can't this be like let out to the masses and let everybody know, like, hey, look, you're going down the wrong path?
Well, it's a reasonable question to ask, and maybe at some point that would actually happen, but it's a very uphill struggle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we tend to have the assumption if something is true and obvious, we should expect that everyone is immediately aware of it, and it should long ago have been taken for granted. But if you look back at history, you'll find that even in areas where we now know many truths, those truths were not very well received for a long time. You know, people accept many kinds of scientific propositions, but when they were first advanced, the people who were propounding them had a very hard time.
World is round, flat, all that.
Just think, nobody questions today that the Earth revolves around the sun. But at one time, that was heretical. And your life would be at stake for propounding that. When Louis Pasteur discovered the germ theory of disease, which everyone takes for granted today, he was ridiculed by the French Academy of Sciences. They decided that Pasteur is a crackpot. I believe when Arthur Goddard, the great space pioneer, was propounding his theories on rocketry, he was ridiculed in an editorial of the New York Times, claiming he didn't understand elementary physics.
So you're saying you're in good company.
Pardon me?
So you're saying
I don't want to make any personal applications. I do want to point out that you can have new ideas which are fully valid, but they're not immediately accepted. You see, it's very difficult to arrive at any kind of new idea in the first place, but the people who are going to accept it, when they're alone, the first people who accept the new idea, they have to have some unusual qualities too, because they have to be willing to say, yeah, something is true, even though everyone else whom they know would think the opposite. Right. You have to be prepared to do battle for a while.
That's true.
So this is what impedes the progress of new ideas, even if they're correct.
I've had to face that myself and try to explain some of the principles in this class to my wife, who's a social worker.
Yeah.
So I
and there are all kinds of obstacles that you can encounter. If you try to explain something about productivity and its relationship to real wages, most people will not even listen because they think they have a very different explanation. So you just think, everyone is aware, at least implicitly, if you ask them, what was the productivity of labor in 1800 compared to today, or 1900 compared to today? What do we all know as a matter of simple history, knowing when different inventions occurred and became common? What kind of productivity of labor do you think they had in 1800?
Very little.
It was very, very primitive.
Industrial revolution was still young.
Right. I mean, now, but why do people think the standard of living was so horribly low in 1800? Do you think they say, oh, well, it was regrettably we had such a poor productivity of labor, it couldn't have been otherwise. What explanation do most people actually have?
Rich and poor.
Yeah, that the greedy capitalists then had a free hand to exploit the workers. Nothing was done to stop them. That's why conditions were so bad. Mm. Why did things improve? Is it because we were improving?
Right.
What?
They say labor unions.
The labor unions, government intervention. The idea is that things were bad not because of anything physical, not because of the state of technology, anything of that kind. Things were bad because the greedy capitalists had a free hand in exploiting everyone. Now, if you think seriously about that, that's utterly bizarre. It would be saying the average worker in 1800 didn't have a television set. Why not? Because the damn capitalists were watching them all. or people were starving. Why? Because the capitalists were eating each of them for 10,000. I mean, it's just sheer lunacy, but that's what people believe. They think it's an issue of redistribution, social justice. They're not looking at very simple elementary facts like the productivity of labor. Now, what can you do with these cases? I think sometimes you'd have to grab some of these people, sit on them for 6 months, and pound it into their heads. Maybe they'd understand it, but I doubt it. Yes, Mr. Rosen.
In the past 30 years, have real wages increased or decreased?
That's a very good question. I'd have to say it's not clear. There are some respects in which they've increased and others which they've decreased.
In the past 50 years?
In the past 50 years, I'd say they probably have risen. But the rise should have been, we should have had a substantial rise in real wages, but we certainly have not. At least there have been things working against it.
Such as government intervention?
And growing government intervention. And we'll have a good idea if we pursue this analysis a little further. Because I'm maintaining that real wages depend, A, on the productivity of labor, and B, the productivity of labor depends on the amount of capital goods per worker. So what's crucial for the productivity of labor is capital accumulation. And we want to have a situation where the average worker is able to work with the aid of more and better capital goods. That will enable him to produce more and more as time goes on, and that's what raises real wages. So now our job is to start explaining what is required for capital accumulation. And this brings us into point B, and I say the supply of capital goods depends on the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. The demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. Why? Well, this determines the relative production of capital goods. The relative production of capital goods, which must exceed the proportion necessary for maintenance if capital accumulation is to take place. Now let me try to illustrate this idea. We can use a very simple illustration to get started. Let's take the case of an isolated, self-sufficient farmer. He's starting with a supply of seed, and he produces a crop. He uses up his seed to produce his crop. Where does he get fresh seed from?
From his crop.
Out of the crop. Now, his seed stands for his capital. That's capital in his context.
The first seed that he acquires whatever way?
Well, we're not interested necessarily in the very first seed.
Okay.
He starts the year with a supply of seed, which he's managed to accumulate by whatever means. It might be that we're greeting him after there's been a million years of previous human history. We're jumping in at this point. It's planting time. He's got a supply of seed.
Okay.
He uses up his seed in the production of his crop. He has to get a supply of replacement seed out of the crop.
Okay.
Now, let's assume, to make it easy, that our farmer is able to take one bushel of seed, and that's sufficient to get 4 bushels of crop. What does this imply about the proportion of his crop that he needs to devote to seed in order to have as much seed next year as he has this year?
One-fourth.
Now, this one-fourth, the proportion of the output that's required to replace the capital goods used up in producing it, that we call the maintenance proportion. The maintenance proportion. That's the proportion of the output needed to replace the capital goods used up in producing it. In this example, it's 25%. Now, if our farmer were to accumulate capital goods, if we were to have more capital goods next year than he had this year, what proportion of his output would need to take the form of capital goods?
The same.
As a minimum. If we would have more.
Oh, he wants more next year?
Yeah, he wants to have capital accumulation, so he'll have more seed to start next year than he had to start this year.
I say
more than a fourth. So in order for him to have capital accumulation, if his condition is that one bushel of seed results in 4 bushels of crop, and he has a maintenance proportion of 25%, in order for him to have capital accumulation, he needs to have a proportion of his output going to seed that is greater than 25%. If he devotes 30% of his output to seed, he'll have more than a bushel. He'll have more capital goods next year than the year before. Now, this example of an isolated, self-sufficient farmer has application to the most complicated economy when you take it as a whole. We have to abstract from seed our capital goods. They have a nature similar to seed, We have cement factories, steel mills, all of the plant and equipment, the railroad network, the phone lines, everything, all of our presently existing means of production. What is happening to all of our means of production in the course of further production? They're getting used up, they're wearing out. Some things, the materials, like the flour, the steel sheet, they're getting used up in their entirety in producing their products. The steel mills, the cement factories, the railroad network, that's wearing out, depreciating. Sooner or later, it needs replacement too. Sooner or later, all of the capital goods need replacement. But what is the physical source of replacement from the perspective of the economy as a whole? Where does the economy as a whole get the capital goods to replace the capital goods being used up?
Natural resources.
Well, the natural resources enters in. Physically, where do we get the replacements?
We get it from other sellers.
The economy as a whole. Where does the economy whole as a whole? Where do we get the ability to replace the flour used up in making bread? Where do we get the wheat used up in making flour? We have to produce more. We have to have fresh production. Where do we get the ability to replace the steel mills when they need replacing? And the machines that are wearing out. We have to produce that, right?
Right.
The economy as a whole is in the process of using up existing capital goods, and it has to continually produce fresh capital goods.
Right.
We need, if we look at our total output, our gross product is comparable to the farmer's crop. The capital goods we're using up are comparable to the farmer's seed. The farmer uses up his seed, he gets replacement seed from his crop. We're using up capital goods. Where do we get the replacement capital goods? Out of our gross product. We get the replacement capital goods out of what we produce. Now, if we're to have capital accumulation, if we're to have more capital goods at the beginning of next year than we have at the beginning of this year, we have to produce more capital goods than we're using up. Just as our farmer has to produce more new seed compared to the seed he's using up. So in order for us to have capital accumulation, we have to produce more capital goods than we use up in the course of production. More capital goods than we use up in producing both capital goods and consumers' goods. Now, what will determine how much of our effort we devote to the production of capital goods? See, here we are, we have the overall ability we can produce, and we have within a considerable range, it's a matter of choice. We could produce more capital goods and fewer consumers' goods, or more consumers' goods and fewer capital goods.
The demand,
the relative demand will determine the relative production. See, what is it that determines the size of the cigar industry relative to the soft drink industry? The relative demand. The soft drink industry will be much bigger because there's a much greater demand for soft drinks relative to cigars. Well, the extent to which we produce capital goods relative to consumers' goods depends on the relative demands. We have, at any given time, a certain overall total ability to produce, but how we direct that ability, that depends on the strength of the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. Now, I introduce an illustration which is somewhat complex, but I think minimally complex given the actual complexity of the subject matter we're trying to capture. I have a couple of tables, or figures, I should say. Let me go over this step by step. This is figure 14.4 on page 624, titled The Relative Production of Capital Goods in a Stationary Economy. A stationary economy, pardon me?
7, 10, and 7
pages.
Oh,
yeah. No. Excuse me?
No, these are different. There's a couple different versions.
This is the simplest version of the figures. I introduce additional complexity as we go on, but this is the basic way to begin. Here we are. We're looking at things over a series of years. Notice we have year one, year two, three, four, on down to year N. Now, it's always very helpful in thinking about economics to think in terms of concrete quantities. Don't just float off in the air. Always quantify everything in some way. So here we are. I'm saying in year one, we have 1K of capital goods. I say K, I know how to spell capital goods, but we're using C for consumers' goods, so we'll have K for capital goods. So we start off, we have 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor, and that's our groundwork for production. Now, we know that capital goods are getting used up and worn out. There are some things that are used up in their entirety, like the materials. You can only use a material one time. You can't use the same material more than once in production. The machinery and the buildings, they in fact last many years, but they are getting used up sooner or later. Now I'm introducing a major simplifying assumption here. I'm assuming that all the capital goods in existence at the start of the year will be used up in that year. I know that's not true, but I'm doing this to simplify the analysis. We know they all are used up sooner or later, and instead of having to follow 98 different things, these capital goods are used up over 20 years, these are used up over 5 years, these are used up over 2 years. To get a handle on things, we're assuming that everything is used up in the same year. And once we have that down, it's possible to go on and see what happens if some things are used up over 2 years. And then we can introduce 5 years and on. But to get a handle on things, we need to make them as simple as possible. And the simplifying assumption is that all the capital goods in existence at the beginning of the year are used up in that year. And so this 1K is going to be used up in the course of production, irrespective of what we produce. Now, I'm assuming there are two basic categories of goods that can be produced, that we can use the existing 1K of capital goods and the labor that's available, 1L of labor. They could be used to produce different possible combinations of capital goods or consumers' goods. And to make our job as simple as possible, I'm assuming that at one limiting extreme, we could conceivably, if we did nothing but produce capital goods, we could produce 2K of capital goods and no consumers' goods. That would be at one extreme. Or at the opposite extreme, we could produce 2C of consumers' goods and no capital goods. These are the two extremes. Now, let me point out, to touch base with reality again, in reality, the labor can be used pretty much to produce capital goods or consumers' goods. For example, the people working for General Motors, I'm sure all of them could be equally well employed in producing passenger automobiles for consumers, certainly passenger automobiles for business and taxi cab fleets, or heavy trucks for major industrial companies, or diesel locomotives. The labor is usable. The raw materials, to a large degree, could be devoted either to producing capital goods or consumers' goods. The physical facilities could be devoted either to the one or to the other within large limits. So it's not unreasonable to assume that the same means of production can be used to produce either capital goods or consumers' goods. That's the basic case. And our extremes are we could produce 100% capital goods and zero consumers' goods, in which case we'd have 2K of capital goods, or we could produce 0K of capital goods and 2C of consumers' goods. Now, either extreme outcome would be disastrous. What would happen if we produced 2C of consumers' goods and no capital goods? Then the following year, we'd be without capital goods. We'd be reduced to the level of our caveman ancestors. So we'd have 1 year of party, and that would be the end. On the other hand, if we attempted to produce only capital goods, we would probably die of starvation before we could get the benefit of the additional ability to produce. So we always want something somewhere, not at the extreme. All right, now here we are. If it's the case that with 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor, if we concentrated 100% on capital goods, we'd get 2K of capital goods. Well, what proportion of our output needs to be capital goods simply to replace the 1K being used up?
50%.
Yes?
50%.
50%. So notice, here we are. We're looking at year one. We're looking at production going from year one into year two. And we're assuming that we have a 50-50 relative production, a 50-50 relative production. And if we have that, we'll get 1K of capital goods, and we'll have 1C of consumers' goods. Because at the 100% extremes, we could have 2, 0, or 0, 2. So 50-50 is 1 and 1. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to bring about this 50-50 relative concentration, relative production? Well, that will be the anticipation of the relative demands. Notice I say this 50% is in response to a demand for capital goods of 500. This 50% is in response to a demand for capital goods of 500. If here we are in our entire economy, we have a total demand for products of both descriptions taken together of 1,000. If the relative demand is 500-500, what kind of relative production will that result in? 50-50, right? We'll have 50-50 relative production if we have a 50-50 relative demand. Okay, now, so here we are. We've got these 500-500 relative demands. So in year one, we use up 1K of capital goods in the course of producing a fresh 1K and also 1C of consumers' goods. In year two, these 1K of capital goods right here, these become the capital goods used in production. They're produced starting here. We produce 1K of capital goods. These 1K are now added to a fresh 1L of labor in year two, and they're used the same way. We assume that in each year, year after year, indefinitely, we have a 500-500 relative demand. So what's happening in each year? How much capital goods are we using up? How much are we producing? We're using up 1K, we're reproducing 1K, and so we're standing pat. We have a stationary economy. And this can go on indefinitely, all the way to year end. All right, but now we want to deal with the question, how do we get out of this rut? How do we get out of a stationary economy into a progressing economy? We need to produce more than 1K of capital goods. Okay. If we can do that, we'll have a higher productivity of labor, a greater ability to produce. And to illustrate that, we need to go to figure 14.5, the relative production of capital goods in a progressing economy. Now here we are, we're in year one, and we again have just 1K of capital goods, and we have 1L of labor, but there's going to be a significant difference compared to figure 14.4. And that is, there is a change in the relative demand for capital goods and consumers' goods. And we're assuming that starting in year two, from year two on, the demand for capital goods is going to be 600 instead of 500. The demand for consumers' goods is going to be 400 instead of 500. What would bring about such a shift?
Savings.
If people decide they want to save more, provide more for the future, consume less. Let's say up to this point, they've had a certain view of the future relative to the present. Their attitudes can change. They can decide they want to provide more for the future than they have been, and if they do that, they'll consume less. They save more. Their savings are used to make a demand for capital goods. This change is anticipated back in year one. The producers in year one anticipate that starting in year two, there's going to be this change in the relative demands. So how will that affect the way they use the factors of production in year one? How are they going to devote the factors of production? They're going to they'll make it 60-40 rather than 50-50. So now here we are. We've got 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor. We know that if we produced 100%, we'd have 2K. What should we expect to produce if we're devoting 60% to the production of capital goods? What is 60% of 2?
1.2.
And what is 40% of 2C? 0.8C. So this is how we get the supplies in year two. We'll have 1.2K of capital goods produced in response to this greater relative demand. There's 60-40 relative demand, and we'll have only 0.8C of consumers' goods. Now, just to flesh this out a bit, you could envision in the auto industry, they cut back somewhat on their production of passenger automobiles. They produce more trucks and locomotives. In the construction industry, they cut back on the construction of residential housing. They build more factory and office buildings. In the appliance industry, they produce fewer consumer appliances, more equipment for business firms. This would be the nature of the way things would occur. You'd have some labor and capital goods withdrawn from the production of consumers' goods and moved into the production of capital goods. That's how we would do it. All right, what would be the effect now in year two? What's the supply of capital goods available in year two?
1.2.
Okay, now we have capital accumulation, we've got 1.2K. And now I'm going to introduce another simplifying assumption, which I think in its essence is correct. I'm going to assume that the productivity of labor is in proportion, in simple direct proportion, to the supply of capital goods. So if now we have 20% more capital goods, I'm assuming that our overall total ability to produce is going to be 20% greater. Before, we could only produce a limit of 2. But now, instead of having 1K, we have 1.2K. So we should be able, on this assumption, to produce 20% more. So how much capital goods should we be able to produce if we were to do nothing but produce capital goods?
2.4.
We should be able to produce 2.4 capital goods. On the other hand, if we were to do nothing but produce consumers' goods, how much consumers' goods should we be able to produce?
2.4.
Pardon me?
2.4.
The extremes, the limiting extremes, have increased by 20%. Instead of 2.002, it's now 2.40, 0.2.4. Those are the extremes. Okay, well, what will happen if we continue with this 60-40 relative percentage? Assume that we've made this relative change, and now we're sticking to it. What is 60% of 2.4? 1.44. What is 40% of 2.4? 0.96. Now, notice we've increased our ability to produce because we have more capital goods. We have 1.2 instead of 1. What does that imply about our ability to produce not only more consumers' goods, but very, very importantly, more capital goods? We can produce more of both. On the foundation of more capital goods, we can produce more of both. Now, here we are in year three. In year three, what will be the supply of capital goods? In year three, the supply that we're producing with in year three is this 1.44. Mm-hmm. Now, if the output per unit of capital goods stays the same, if for every unit of capital goods we have, or every decimal part of a unit of capital goods, we can produce 2 units of output, what should be our limiting parameters on a foundation of 1.44K? 2.88. The extremes are expanding. We're assuming that for every unit or partial unit of capital goods that we have, we can produce 2 units of output, just like the farmer with his seed. We're assuming some constant relation between the supply of capital goods and the ability to produce output. Now, here we are. We've got 1.44K, and now that means a limiting extreme of 2.88. What's 60% of 2.88? Well, 1.726, and now notice very interestingly, what's 40% of 2.88? 1.152. Now this is significant because what has happened now finally to the production of consumers' goods, even though we're devoting a smaller proportion of our output to them? They have increased, and they would go on increasing. At this rate, we would have a 20% annual expansion in the production of both. Now, this is an unrealistically high rate of increase, and it derives from the fact that we assume all the capital goods are used up within 1 year, and so we're able to get big percentage increases. But there are real world cases, and some very substantial real world cases, of countries having a continuing compound rate of increase in production of 6, 7, 8%. Can anyone think of some examples?
China.
China right now. Japan from 1950 to 1990, roughly. South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, all of these so-called Asian tigers. These are countries which have had very rapid rates of progress. And notice also what kind of rates of saving have they had?
High rates.
Very high rates. Now, you can understand the progress of a country like Japan in terms of this analysis. Back in 1950, Japan was a miserably poor country, ranked way down in the list of the world's economies. But with the little that they could produce in 1950, they devoted a very large proportion of that to the production of capital goods, a sufficiently high proportion so that in 1951, they had noticeably more capital goods than they had in 1950. What did that enable them to do in 1951? They can produce significantly more than they could in 1950. And of that larger output, again, a substantial proportion was capital goods. So they had more capital goods available at the start of 1952 than they had in 1951. So they could produce more in 52 than in 51. Well, now you do this for 40 years, increasing your total ability to produce by 5, 6% a year. And what does that amount to if you have a calculator? What's 1.06 to the 40th power? That'll be quite substantial. And so a country can rise from the depths of poverty to being a first-class modern world economic power on the foundation of policies that enable it to devote a substantial proportion of whatever it can produce to the production of capital goods. Now, this depends on policies that are pro-saving and investment. That's an essential ingredient for economic progress. Last question, then we have to take our break.
A break?
For the week.
Oh, okay.
For the week. I didn't plan to have you come back. You can come back. I'm leaving.
Are you talking, what kind of policies? Are you talking about tax incentives?
Taxes, yeah. Okay, raise this next week.
All right,
okay.
Got it.
And we'll discuss it. It's on the agenda.
Okay,
have a good week, you all.
And thank you.
I'm sure we'll have an interesting night ahead of us.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting to see what's going on.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Do a policy.
We have to deal with it.